Okay, we're back, and this is part two of the Massachusetts Technology Leadership Council's Open Source SIG, Open Source and the Enterprise, Enterprise Adoption. We just heard this wonderful presentation from Nick at Gardner, and thank you very much for all the questions and discussions among people. That's what seems to make this group work, is it is a real give and take. And thank you for letting us record it for those others out there who couldn't be here and will hopefully come next time. The more people have shown up, and it's been standing room only in here now, where we had, I don't know, it's what, like 40 people or something, like 40 people or something like that. So the people who came in who weren't here before, how many of you are lawyers? No, the lawyers come on time, and they're not even billing. That's just wonderful. You bill by, yeah, but it's not, this, unless they're, maybe they're, one of their clients are here and they're billing for it. And how many of you are in companies, big companies or small, that are using open source software? The people who came in. How many are press? I know we have some press. For those of you to know, we do have press here, and we have bloggers here. So, and we're recording it. So, you know, if you want something to be off the record, that's what the networking time is for, okay? And be careful about that. So, so we decided for today to break it into two parts. One is to have the analyst telling us what they see, you know, what is seen looking at the whole industry from, you know, looking at the forest. And I think we got a good view of that. But now let's get down into the trees and the leaves and see what individual companies are actually finding out and how do they find this stuff. And luckily, now that we're the Technology Leadership Council, not just the Software Council, we have members who are companies that use technology, not ones that sell technology. And we have representatives of two major local companies who are willing to tell us about what their development's like, how they're using open source, or whatever else they think will get you in the mood of understanding how open source relates to their company. And we'll have a little bit from them, about 10 minutes, I guess, 5 or 10 minutes each, whatever you want to do. They have some presentations or slide decks or not, whatever. And then, so try to hold back the discussion, scribble down what you want to know about that, because then let's get into a discussion. I assume some of the people here in the audience also have examples to talk about, and we can talk about what exactly. I know from having heard from some of them that there's some very specific reasons why they're using open source that have nothing to do with the fact that it doesn't cost money to buy it in the first place. And we should understand what those are. And I think there's some help that some people are going to need among each other of what works and what doesn't work. And how did you get your lawyers to accept this and things like that. So let us start. I guess we're going to start with Julie. So the first person, I have her bio here. I won't have the others, so they're going to have to give it themselves. Julie Atkins is Director of IT Operations and Info Security at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. She's the Senior Director of IT Operations Delivery and Information Security of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, responsible for all data center operations, web services, production support, enterprise architecture, quality assurance, desktop LAN services, network telephony and security infrastructure and compliance. Phew, it's a lot. Since joining Blue Cross Blue Shield in May of 2003, she's focused on delivering solid enterprise solutions with enhanced availability and security. Most recently, she's been concentrating on modifications to the architectural framework to support increased personalization of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts websites by integrating infrastructure and business services to provide access based on individual preferences, which sounds like what a lot of companies are doing now, which is good. And also that's what the state is doing, and that's what's driving a lot of this new development, which we hear from Nicholas. A lot of new development is happening with open source. Prior to Blue Cross, Julie served as Director of Systems Engineering and Operations for Houghton Mifflin Company in Boston. There she provided innovative technical solutions to support the company's publishing and web services needs. She's also held a leadership role at Lightbridge, which was formerly Credit Technology, and various technical roles at the Analytical Sciences Corporation. So she has a lot of experience here. Julie, let's hear what you have to say.
Well, after that job description, it sounds like I should take the rest of the day off. Thank you for having me here today. I am not a litigator. Don't want any legal questions. Send them over to Nick, please. I really just want to give you an idea of what we're using over at Blue Cross from an open source perspective, kind of where we're headed. And I'll focus more on some of the challenges that we face in evaluating whether we should move towards open source or continue down the path of, you know, commercial products. Currently, we don't look at ourselves as a big open source user. We have, you know, we recognize some of the benefits, and I think Nick went through them all from a cost perspective and some of the flexibility and so on, and sort of the trends that are happening. One of the things, if we really look at where we are from an open source perspective, I think when you look at the maturity chart that Nick went over, we are leaning towards the ones that are more mature. We have some Linux operating systems running, and they're mostly in a support role, managing some of our remote servers, managing some of just kind of data center management stuff. We do have some development stuff from a Perl perspective, XML parsers, things like that, kind of tools. That's really the significant portion of what we're doing from an open source. We are a customer of the JESStack, and if things move along as we may see, we become a bigger open source user than we were in the past. We are focusing on really looking. The Sun JESStack.
Oh, Sun.
Yep. So we are, and that was purchased about a year and a half ago. We're really focusing on trying to compartmentalize some of our services so we can get a more of a plug and play. Traditionally, Blue Cross has developed huge applications that were kind of end-to-end, a little complex, and like everyone, to get, you know, reusability and things like that, we are reevaluating how we've done things in the past. Policies around our open source, we really take it a case-by-case basis. And when we look at the option of do we use open source, we really evaluate it. What does it do for us now? What's the cost? What are the long-term costs, which we do have to really look at very carefully because we have to make predictions on setting our rates and things like that. We look at the audience of developers, kind of the trend of the product and things like that. So it really isn't a one-time kind of policy that we write that we never go back to. One of the things we did over the last year or so is we took Nick pointed out that on some of the applications, replacement of old applications is really not the trend. Blue Cross doesn't always follow the trend. We did replace one of the old reporting engines that we had on our mainframe. We created a web interface to it, and we're using Apache and Tomcat to support that. That's an internal application. It's not necessarily one of our business applications that are externally facing. In looking at some of the difficulties, we are a regulated, highly regulated industry. We have regulations that come down from the Blue Cross Association, which we are an independent licensee of. We have state regulations, and we have federal regulations. So when you start talking about some of those things, and you look at where maybe we're less mature in some of the open source areas, I think security is one, and that's one we really focus on, that with the HIPAA guidelines that everyone is aware of within the healthcare industries, that's an important part for us. So we really take a lot of thought, and when we look at open source, what does that mean for us? Obviously, the association does mandate some things to us. Sometimes they mandate software that we have to use. So that takes away some of the opportunities to look at open source. I think that the biggest challenge is that, and this is probably not necessarily healthcare, but for Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts, we're majority outsourced. We outsource everything that we feel is not a core competency of the business. So we outsource our data center management. We outsource all of our development, and we do that to a three-bid process to stay competitive. So you can see when you start looking at some of those things, we have not only a data center management and application operation that happens externally from Blue Cross, we then have to abide by some of their guidelines in order for them to meet their SLAs for us and things like that. And it does add a challenge when you look at open source. Having a development, an outsourced development, we have strict guidelines. So when we put things out for a bidding process or an RFP process to bring in and look at developers to come on board, what we do from a timeline perspective, sorry, what we do from a timeline perspective is really we have to give people clear understandings of what we're looking for from an RFP process in order to get scope correctly and things like that. It leaves little room for some of the, you know, kind of conversations around open source. A lot of the things that we've done, being a partner of EDS and a licensee of the association, we do get pretty aggressive on some of our contracts with third parties and things like that. So when you start looking at the trends of open source and how that's affected the market of commercial products, I mean, with OS now included in, could you take care of that for me? With the OS included in the, you know, in the hardware area, and you know, we can use aggressive discounts and leverage our partners for that. I think some of the commercial products, at least for Blue Cross Blue Shield, we get some aggressive pricing, which when you look at the cost of this from a from an open source perspective, we do play in an aggressive role. So I think from evaluating open source, obviously where we go with the Sun Jez stack will probably put us in a different world. But right now we're really looking at things case by case, really evaluating what makes sense here now with the long-term setting so that we can look and control our costs going forward. Blue Cross is not you know, opposed to open source. I think we will continue to evaluate it and look at the opportunities as they arise.
If you outsource application development in the Java area, for instance, will you allow open source modules to be included in the deliverable from your outsourced vendor?
We will certainly keep an open mind on that. When we go out and look at solutions and have vendors come in and actually present their solutions, there is an area that they can present unique things. It's not sort of we dictate every component of the development. It's part of going out through that process is to hear some different things in the industry. One of the things that is insourced is we have our architectural enterprise team that is insourced and reports into my area. They generally set the long-term direction. So I think as we look at open source, although we wouldn't be opposed to a development party presenting that to us, I think it would be a direction set by the architectural team.
Why don't we get the second? Okay, can you talk about open source? Well, we'll ask you questions.
Okay.
Now we have from Fidelity, we have two people, Mike Askew and Chuck Picklehop, and tell us who you are and what part of Fidelity Investments you're involved with, and then your presentation.
Great, sure. My name is Mike Askew, and I head up something called the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, which is an emerging technology group. It's quite a small group. I'm sorry? My name is Mike Askew, and I head up the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, which is an emerging technology group. And Chuck, who's going to speak in a minute, works for me in the capacity of the emerging open source space. Now, I've been with Fidelity for 10 years. I've been in the software industry for about 20 years. I started off with Unix kernel validation and worked on market data distribution systems as well as trading systems, and eventually came to Fidelity about 10 years ago. So what we're going to talk about is a little bit of history of open source at Fidelity and some of the trends that have happened over the last couple of years, and then the way we're using it today. And hopefully it'll be a, kind of an interesting overview for you. So the early days, 10 years ago when I arrived at Fidelity, you know, Unix was our predominant desktop. The Spark 20 was on every trader's desktop. It was the Lexus of machines. They really liked it. PCs were there, but they certainly weren't for the power users at that point. Certainly not in the investment management space, which is where I was. There were a whole number of development tools which are open source that we were using, GCC and so on. But quite surprisingly to me, there was actually major systems written in open source even then. In fact, the whole of the equity trading environment was written using TCL Tickle. So even back then, in 95, there were really a system that was responsible for 9% of the New York Stock Exchange volume was actually an open source based application. So 9%. I don't know what the dollar figure was back then, but so open source has been at Fidelity for a long time. I don't want you to think that it's something that we've recently come across. Now, one of the slides that Nick showed us earlier was this maturity versus application. And I've got a kind of slightly different spin on that. On the little slide that I'm showing here, I have a maturity versus time chart. And a certain point in the applications that I've highlighted here, Tickle, Struts, Linux, Firefox, and OpenOffice, there's a point where it goes from being an emerging technology, the kinds of things that we look at in our group, into a mainstream enterprise adopted application. Now, that barrier is changing. In the early days, it was much easier for us to get open source into the environment. And the reason for that was because the developers were really working alongside the business units. And we were still very cognizant of licensing. Even then, we would have the legal groups review the licensing for Tickle. But it was so much simpler. It was so much easier. You know, we download Tickle on a Monday night, and by Tuesday, 9% of the New York Stock Exchange volume was going through it. I mean, it was really amazing times when you think about it. And that's really changed a lot. Now that the kind of barriers towards using open source are a little higher because people's expectations are higher. You know, 9/11 has caused us to focus a lot on disaster recovery and geographic redundancy and you know, is the company able to support us given certain situations? And so expectations are really have really started to go up a lot. The next kind of... there were lots of business drivers for the open software that we used as well. For Tickle TK, in those days, it was really the functionality. It was a scripting language. We could recreate the user interface and reply to business requirements almost instantly. It was terrific. But then we started to use Struts Plus in the infrastructure space, not because of really functionality, although you know, performance was certainly one of the things we were looking for, but it was business risk. We didn't want the core of our business to be owned by a particular vendor. We wanted independence from that. And so, you know, we are an e-business, a true e-business. 90-95% of our transactions come through the web. It's a very important channel for us. So that whole highly scalable infrastructure, we wanted to own it. And that's why we went with the Apache, Jakarta, Struts Plus environment. Like the rest of the world, we jumped into Linux basically because of the cost performance. Out of the 11 or 12,000 servers that we have in our space today, I'm guessing 10 to 15% of them are Linux-based. We also have one of every kind of operating system that you can mention as well, unfortunately. But some of our more recent work is very interesting. We've been working with the Mozilla Foundation for the last year on an exercise that really started off being driven by security. And Firefox is just about reaching that critical mass where we could adopt it in our enterprise as the different browser, eliminating the monoculture of IE. And that kind of process of understanding what our intranet is like and understanding what it would take our applications and get them working in Firefox has really opened our eyes to standards, and we've become much more aware of the importance of standards in our development and governance in general. And that's one of the things that Chuck's going to talk a little bit about too. I've got OpenOffice on the end here. We have started to look at OpenOffice. We started with a 1.1 evaluation. I think I mention it later on here. How interchangeable are OpenOffice documents with Microsoft Office was one of those key things that we wanted to look into. The portability of documents, the actual formats themselves, is very important, and I really want to emphasize how important that work is that's being done in Massachusetts, which is great, on formats. In 95, I was responsible for taking that Unix desktop and moving it to a PC, and then we had the pain to go through of converting hundreds of thousands of Excel model spreadsheets from Office 95 to 2000. And I think the enterprises have forgotten how much pain that really was. And without protecting yourself against that in the future, you're making a big mistake, I feel. So it's really worth enforcing that kind of approach to open formats. I think it's very, very important. Coming down to OpenOffice again, we're working with 2.0 right now. We actually have a usability lab where we invite members from the public when we're doing evaluations of Fidelity.com. But in this case, people within Fidelity who have specific experience in Excel and Word and PowerPoint and so on to try out the application, use it for a month or so, and then come back to us and give us their feedback. And that process with OpenOffice 2.0 has just started. We should have some kind of formal results from that probably in early January. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Chuck, and Chuck can tell you a little bit about himself and talk a little bit about some of the risks that we have and how we're organized.
Thanks, Mike. Chuck Picklehaupt, also with Fidelity. I've been with the firm about 14 years, and I've been working a lot in the FMR space. This is the fund management organization. About 9 years building, architecting, and managing software products for the equity fund managers and research analysts. And about a year ago, I came over to join the Center for Applied Technology. In both spaces, we've been using a lot of open source. So not just Tickle space and equity trading, but also in the Java platform space. And we've come across a number of issues in getting real products into production. Now, we talk about two different use cases within our firm, and that really makes a difference when using open source. As mentioned earlier, are you using the products internally for corporate customers only, or are you sharing what you're doing with the web in general? So is it fidelity.com, or is it internal to our firm? And that is a great divider, and that helps us make some determinations. So when we're taking a look at some risks as we're evaluating each piece of open source before we use it, we come upon some interesting issues. So licensing, which has been mentioned in the past. Many different licenses, how do they play together? Deep pockets problem. So with any kind of litigation, people tend to go after the people who have the most money in their pockets, and Fidelity might be a big target. So we just need to be aware of that and make sure that any licenses are properly vetted. We've talked a little bit about enterprise class support. There's no throat to choke. If something goes wrong, who are we going to yell at? Who is there to blame? We've covered most of these already. But the big question comes down to, given these issues and others, how are we going to nominate and approve a given piece of free and open source software for use within the firm? Who's going to make these decisions? How do we make sure that we're not going to proliferate numerous versions? Some pieces of open source software have new builds every single night. Which version are you going to choose? Which version are you going to take? It's a huge challenge. And then, how are we going to communicate with the open source community? Are we going to say we're Fidelity Investments? Are we going to go through third-party intermediaries? We've created a corporate standard within our firm. This was released earlier this year, and we got together legal teams, development staff, management, and we came together to say, what is the best way to go after this and get it done in a good way? So let's mitigate our risks, and let's make sure that we set up some level of governance around the use of open source. We have a widely dispersed organization. We have development staff in 8 different locations in the U.S. We have other locations internationally as well. And it's very difficult to have one central organization that might be the governor for what any given group would use. So one of the tenets of our solution is that it would have to be reasonably dispersed, reasonably high speed, and that it wouldn't slow down the pace of innovation. So obviously we came up with standards for how are we going to use, evaluate, certify, support, and maintain a given piece of software, and how we're going to submit changes back to the environment when appropriate. At a high level, someone will say, I need a piece of functionality. So I'm going to talk with regular vendors, or I'm going to look at the open source community. They have to look at our internal governance roadmap. So we do have structure around, make sure that your stack is a Java stack, make sure that you're using particular databases, make sure you're using particular pieces of hardware. After that, there's some flexibility. Is there a new component that you saw out in SourceForge? Fantastic. Take a look at it, evaluate it yourself before you actually release it to production. You need to come to our open source review board and say, here's a piece of software. It's not on the roadmap. I've already checked our common repository where reuse lives, and I'd like to suggest a new piece for inclusion in that. So we do a very lightweight review. We take a look at the licenses. We have a team of about 6 people who have worked closely with our internal legal teams to understand some of the basics about licenses. We don't claim to be lawyers. We don't claim to understand all the details, but we do know enough to be able to read a document and say, this doesn't violate any of our big tenets. With the given business unit's use case, to use a piece of software internally or externally, to either link against it or to modify the code itself, then we can look at a license and say, yes, this seems appropriate or not. And then we basically give a thumbs up or thumbs down. We're not saying whether or not it's truly the best piece of software for the job. We're just saying this is not going to put Fidelity at risk. And then we leave it up to another team to deal with governance and whether the performance, et cetera, whether it's really the best software. And that relatively lightweight process has really helped us a lot. We have already put dozens of pieces of software through this process and made determinations about things that are good, things that should not be in the enterprise as well. Now, in some cases, we want to release our code back to the environment. In the instance of the JetSpeed portal server, we think that that is one project that has a lot of promise. We think that portal technologies over the next 5 to 10 years are going to become very commodity. While there certainly are differentiators with vendors today, we think in the long term that it really is technology that anyone should be able to do. So to that instance, we're working with that community to submit some changes back, some suggestions that we think are important to bring that open source project up to snuff with a vendor-provided piece of software. So many of these, for you listening, are standard tools that most developers would use and people might be using other in the space. Struts, as Mike mentioned, Struts Plus is what we have internally. That's a code that we've put on it. The plus is that we did a full, complete evaluation of the entire Struts source code from beginning to end, from a security perspective, from a buffer overflow perspective, you name it. We made some modifications to that. We submitted those changes back to the Struts community as well. We wanted to do that because we wanted to be able to run pieces of Fidelity.com on a piece of software that we are completely comfortable with. We would have done the same with any other vendor to the extent that they would have let us, but of course previous vendors wouldn't have let us. So this makes us even that much more comfortable with running software like this.
And you replaced an internal project too, is that?
Absolutely, absolutely. So there are some internal projects.
That Struts replaced.
Absolutely. So there were internal structures that we used. So when there are platforms built up by these individual development groups for use on Fidelity.com or even internal websites, we've replaced those, eliminating the duplication of effort, eliminating the extra support costs and maintenance costs related to these individual pieces of code that were written over the better part of a decade. So Mike mentioned a couple of applications that we're looking at in the future. So there's an interesting rules engine called Drools that we think has some real value. The Eclipse organization has matured beyond just development tools. They have a number of pieces of infrastructure as well, beyond just their IDE that we think are interesting. Their BERT project might be a business objects competitor. It's still early days for it. They call it 1.0. I'm not sure it's ready for prime time, but that said, 3 years from now, it may be, and so we're keeping an eye on it.
It might be worth spending a minute, actually, just to talk about the Eclipse Foundation, because we have found them to be a very interesting model for open source in that they, the way they're structuring the releases of their software around every 6 months coming out with a major release that covers all the different items within their platform. We think it's really maturing into a real enterprise quality open source environment.
Absolutely. It is a clear distinction. We have been impressed with Eclipse. By setting up those very distinct release dates, milestones, we've been able to plan our releases around them exactly like any other vendor. It really has blurred the lines entirely around what a free or open source vendor is versus a real vendor, and I think it's a great model for other companies to take a look at. So there are some other things up here. An interesting one, very future-looking, is Xen as a competitor to VMware for running virtualized Linux operating systems. We're looking at it for Windows operating systems. They've just proven that it's theoretically possible. They've got some code running that's been hacked up. But over the course of 2006, they claim to be able to do this. It requires particular hardware. Again, it's forward-looking, but we think that they have that has legs. That's the end.
So what I hear is that we have two companies, two large companies, one that uses open source but isn't like really far on the bandwagon and is trying to figure out. But at Blue Cross, you're very concerned about costs because in the medical world we care about costs. And you have regulatory, both companies have regulatory issues which you have to deal with. And you're also part of a larger set of organizations that set standards. I'll be interested in hearing more about standards from you. What I'm hearing is in a financial institution where PE ratios and other risk things matter and stuff like that, You didn't mention cost much at all. You cared about you. What you talked about was risk, about functionality, and are evaluating things based on what you get out of it. One thing I'm going to want is, I know one of the reasons you like the Strut systems has to do with the community. What you look at for any product from anywhere now is the community around that product. And that to you is what, as you said, keeps the risk down and is how you evaluate now proprietary or open source. Is that, do you want to?
Sure.
Yeah, why don't we'll pass this around. Keep it a foot away or so, Chuck.
Sure. Clearly, the community is important. As was mentioned in previous conversations, just like any other vendor, you want to make sure when you're putting something that's mission-critical into your environment that you have a support base, that you know that the product has a long life when appropriate. Now, that said, there are some products that we've looked at that we've pulled from the open-source community that have no community. It was a project that literally was thrown out there and was more or less left to die. This particular one was called Mod NTLM. It's a modification to Apache's HTTP web server that allows you to do single sign-on with NTLM, Windows Authentication. The problem was this project, when it was thrown up there, didn't work with Active Directory. So we brought that in. We made modifications internally to make it work with Active Directory and submitted that back. And thus, the only changes that had taken place within a year were helped by us. So again, when it makes sense, absolutely, it's very important. And anything that's mission critical and certainly customer facing, we want to make sure that we have that.
One of the things I'd like to add with the Mozilla Foundation, our experience has been very positive. We originally went into the whole kind of looking at Firefox as a security concern. And one of the things that we found is that, you know, maybe the number of vulnerabilities is maybe slightly less than IE, but the time it takes for them to correct them and patch them and re-release is much better. And it's really making a big impression upon us in terms of the value of community and how active those projects are in the way that we look at open source now. It's a key point that we want to look at. Is it very active? Who's contributing? It's a key thing.
Want to respond to anything I said, or anything about standards? What have you decided on standards, whether it's open source or not?
Well, most of the things we've done around standards is we are on a J2EE standard. We are looking on open standards as we move to, and when I say community, I'm not talking about sort of the development community that's been referenced here, but when we look at healthcare and the medical community, trying to keep things open and flexible so as we move down the line and we come up with things as we move towards an electronic medical record and how we integrate that across the state of Massachusetts for a number of different hospitals and clinics and even physician offices. I mean, we have to be able to come up with something that we can plug and play. So that's really where we're headed.
How active were the lawyers involved? I heard the lawyers were actively involved with Fidelity. How active have the lawyers been involved in open source internally?
Well, since we haven't really made huge strides, they haven't been that involved. Most of the stuff we're using for open source has been in our data centers and mostly from a systems management perspective.
Questions? Let's see. How are we going to do this? Let's start in the corner and work our way back, I guess, or something. Say who you are and where you're from.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Edward Naughton, Holland & Knight. Interested to hear about your involvement in the community. It sounds like you would pull things out of the community, work on them internally, and then contribute them back. I'm wondering whether you've ever been involved in sponsoring community projects rather than doing the work internally to take advantage of the community development.
Our policy certainly allows us to do that. We have a structure to do that. At this point, because our policy has only been out for a number of months, we haven't sponsored a project purely based on Fidelity previous IP or something that we think is commodity. That said, we certainly have the intent to do it. At some point, I'm not at liberty to say what those projects might be at this point, but yes, we have an intention.
We did work very closely with the Mozilla Foundation to kind of get them into the enterprise thought pattern as release management. Instead of sending a whole great big executable down to the desktop, we just wanted binary differentials. So we've been working with them actively to get that integrated into 1.5. 1.5 will probably be the version that we'll deploy.
So a lot of it is feedback.
Yes.
You do a lot of feedback. Do you do any participation in community or no? Anybody here, just to keep up on this question, anybody here involved in the community stuff as a company or comments about how what you've decided or your lawyers have told you to do or not to do? Nobody else is willing to talk about it. Okay, another question. Let's continue along here. Yes, Nicholas.
How much is your use of Spring displacing a full-blown J2EE?
Well, let me address this in two ways. One, Spring specifically is being widely accepted. People really enjoy it. They think it is in some ways superior, many ways superior. However, with open source and with our community, what we're trying to do is put a cap on the excitement. Of course, to open the floodgates and say, all right, now any open source is ready, willing, and able to enter our firm, that in itself is scary. So some people were very concerned when we were creating this policy that now the floodgates are open, anything can come in. So what we're saying is, for example, we had made a specific decision to base pieces of our infrastructure on struts for a certain number of years. We want to get the lifespan out of that, and so we're not going to continue to jump on the coolest, latest thing no matter what. That said, yes, Spring is approved. Yes, we have a specific release. We've done a full security review of it, and it is approved for use. JSF as well. I mean, there are other pieces of interesting software that's coming. You can't ever avoid developer ennui. I mean, people get bored with the latest and greatest because next week there's something even greater. But we just have to cap that. That's a governance issue, not specifically related to open source.
That enthusiasm actually is one of the reasons why we're very skeptical about applications on the desktop that are open source, because we don't think that there's a lot of longevity in some of those projects. That's why we've chosen very carefully Mozilla and OpenOffice. We really haven't jumped into anything else yet.
Yeah, I guess I'm allowed to ask questions. When you actually started this sort of control board or whatever you're referring to from the open source, how did you get to that? I mean, were there renegades out there and you're kind of rallying them in, or was it something premeditated and that you were getting behind? Where was your starting point?
Well, the starting point is, as Mike described in the presentation, there's been open source in our environment for decades. So we certainly had that to build on. We've had this policy in place. We've had the board in place for a number of months now, and part of it has been handling the new requests coming in. And at the same time, we've got another thread going through to speak with each of the business units and try to pull in the already existing code and bring that in. It's a manual process. It takes time. We're talking with people. What are you using? Inventorying. And a big challenge is dealing with the multiple versions of the exact same software. Someone pulled in as a release from one day. Someone pulled in a different release from another day. And those really are two completely different pieces of source, two completely different versions. And that in itself is a challenge. So standardization is another angle that needs to be addressed. And it'll take time to do it.
Unless somebody really has something to follow up specifically as opposed to a different
role. This is actually kind of a follow-up to that, although it originally started as a question during Julie's presentation, so I'm going to phrase it both ways. Julie, so my question to you is, how sure are you aren't using open source? How sure are you aren't using open source in those proprietary developed projects? And and part two to that is, are you guys at Fidelity using any sort of source code management tools? I'm thinking Black Duck, Palomeda. Are you doing any sort of auditing, I mean, to check which projects are coming in, or are you just relying on people to to tell you what they're doing? So the question to both of you then is, to what extent are you looking at the auditing tools that are becoming available now to control the use of open source that comes into your enterprise? How are you training people? I have Black Duck training at my office at 2:00 today if anybody wants to come.
Well, I'll go ahead. I guess from our perspective, we since we are a regulated company, we do do a bit of auditing. As far as the open source, we don't really have a development staff on site. So it's not like we may have, kind of cowboy developers out there using tools. From our developers that we do bring on, I would imagine they may be using a lot of open source tools similar to that we use in our data center. As far as the underlining things they deliver as far as a product, we have strict guidelines within our RFP process. And as I stated, the enterprise architect team sits on my staff that actually sets these guidelines and standards for them. And then we do some various testing within our testing organization.
Is it something you look for during QA?
I'm sorry?
Is it something you look for during QA, during acceptance?
I think we could do a better job, but we do some of that.
The open source market has really, disruption has really enabled a lot of small companies to emerge in this space, and Fidelity has a venture capital arm, and we've invested in things like Spikesoft and Black Duck. So, you know, we already use those products. We use the Black Duck in-house to kind of check through code, and we have lawyers that pay close attention to licensing and so on. In terms of training of our employees on best practices and so on, I'll let Chuck answer a little bit more specifically in a minute. But one of the other responsibilities that I have is around events which are designed to educate our employees about new evolving emerging standards or corporate standards and so on. And one of those was open source. And Chuck actually ran an event very recently, I think like 2-3 weeks ago, around open source. Dan was there, and maybe he can tell us a little bit about what that was about.
Sure. So as part of training, we have a number of angles. With something this important that touches so many people in the enterprise at the development level, we have set up online training. We've set up on-demand videos. We did license Dan's...
I'm shipping it to today.
We licensed Dan's video to help give people a better perspective. And... I know he's a speaker here, but I do have to say it is a very good video. And so for anyone listening, definitely take a look. But to that end, it is complex, and there's only so much training you can give. You really need it to be top-down. You need management to be educated. You need your engineers and architects to be educated. And it's an ongoing process.
Your presentation you had was videotaped and streamed to people throughout the organization.
Yes, it's available on demand, so it's globally available to groups.
Okay, I guess we're moving along here.
Andy Updegrove, Gessmer Updegrove. Most of the back and forth and analysis on OpenOffice versus the Microsoft XML reference schema has focused more on legal terms, and there have been very few postings on the web so far from a technical point of view. They're starting to trickle out. I'm curious, when you did your review of OpenOffice, did you look at the XML reference schema as an alternative and form an opinion? And going forward with the announcements last week before from Microsoft about submitting XML reference schema to ECMA and then ISA, would that make a difference to you? I'd love to know whether you found one technically superior to the other or whether you consider them to be equivalents.
I can't speak for the 1.1 analysis that we did in terms of the XML reference schema. I don't know about you, Chuck. Would it make a difference? It's a great question. I'm not sure that we've really got a compelling reason to deploy OpenOffice yet. You know, I think that the lack of FreeBSY and Outlook is such a killer application in our space, limits the potential for OpenOffice within our enterprise today. And Microsoft is only going to integrate the collaboration tools more closely into that Office suite. It's going to be very much a different animal by the end of next year. For OpenOffice to replace Microsoft Office in the enterprise is still a ways off, I have to be honest. But I think the move...
Specifically the XML bit, that's the part I'm curious
about. I think that if it was... I haven't read... I did skim across yesterday. We haven't looked at it.
Okay, thanks.
I guess this question is probably for Julie. Oh, Gene Zeigert, Uptaro, sorry. This is probably a question for you. It sounded to me like you thought that you're concerned about the risks and security of open source technology in general. And then I hear the folks from Fidelity say, well, you know, some of the reasons we choose, say, Struts, for instance, is to lower the risk. Because it's an open source technology, they can actually make modifications to it. They have more involvement in it. Or things like Firefox, where they choose it for the security aspect of it rather than less. Do you think that open source technology actually is better, you know, better in security and better in risk, or worse in general?
Well, I guess that's the debate. I don't know that it's better or worse. I think internally, with the business that we're in healthcare and the guidelines around HIPAA, we do take those things and we look at any kind of introduction of software and things like that with a security focus.
I think it's funny to talk about open source in general, because I think it all comes down to the particular project, the functionality, the business case. So it's hard to answer in the general.
Hi, Perry Donham from Collaborative Consulting. I know that you have the Open Software Council that evaluates open source projects for use within Fidelity. This is a Fidelity-specific question. I'm wondering if you do also the reverse, where you evaluate new projects coming online that have been proposed for possibilities to use open source instead of vendor-specific products.
Well, we've addressed that in two ways. So one is, yes, as part of our education and marketing, we say there is a suite of existing open source approved components that people should take a look at instead. Don't build, don't buy, reuse. And that reuse repository is something that we're also building and building. And that repository includes not just open source software, but also some vendor software that has reasonable licensing that allows for reuse in the environment, as well as corporate built software that has gone through a standard process to allow other groups within the firm to use. So I'm not sure I answered your question directly, but we go after reuse as an angle for that.
.NET Commons, you might want to mention.
Sure. And it doesn't just apply to the Java space. It also applies to the .NET space. So Microsoft, they get a lot of bashing, but they did release an interesting library called Enterprise Library, which is a bunch of core components, .NET, that allow you to save yourself from building a whole bunch of things that really are commodity and have already been done before. So we've built a large number of .NET projects based on that enterprise library and some modifications and extensions that we've built.
Oh, Kent Bradford, SoftCheck. When you get a new release of one of these OSS components, do you subject it to any different qualification and testing at a new release level than you would a new release of a commercial product because you don't have the throat to squeeze?
So when there are new releases in the environment, so say on SourceForge there are 12 new releases over the last 12 days, for the most part, we ignore them. So we have more or less built an internal repository where we have gone through and we have said version X of software Y is our approved version and piece of software. And we freeze it. We freeze the code. We build it, the binaries ourselves. And we have, in some sense, our own SourceForge repository internally. And then we have an owner of that project who continually monitors the external project for security enhancements, for new functionality enhancements, for anything that would constitute a requirement for us to update our cached version of that. And at that time, we will do another appropriate review. Appropriate meaning, if it's customer-facing, we'll go through another complete review down to security levels. And if it's not, we might just do a code diff and do an eyeball of what lines changed, and that might be good enough. and we would rebuild a new version, stamp that as our new approved version internally, and have other internal customers go against our internal reuse repository.
But you wouldn't QA it different than a commercial product?
We would QA it appropriately, given that we have the source and that we build it ourselves.
It would really depend on how we're using that particular component. We have obviously very rigorous testing. I think it's an important observation that we're actually behind in our struts version right now. And the fact that we're not so tied to the release schedule of a vendor gives us great flexibility, and it's certainly been a win for us.
So you don't have to move when Microsoft says upgrade, you don't have to upgrade.
Right.
Is that important?
That's very important. That's been a big win for us.
Okay. So we've built that into this open source software model.
But your people have to move when you say move through your proprietary.
That's right.
You have to do that too. You're your own Microsoft.
Just to follow on to that, does that have implications in terms of the support that you can get from the community? So if you're on a back version, are they willing to take issues with a back version?
I brought another mic, but I didn't set it off.
Yes, there are issues. Absolutely. It's in order for us to go back to the community, we have to be responsible. We have to only report issues on the latest version and be a good citizen. So if we find a problem with a piece of software, we stop the presses, we download the latest, we rebuild, we retest. If we can reproduce in that new version, then yes. Or if we found the problem in a piece of code, we can just check the latest source to see if that line or those components have been updated. We do the right thing. Absolutely.
Thank you. My name is John Friedman. I'm a marketing consultant. I guess a question for both companies. Have you looked at applications from software vendors where the vendor says, I'm basing this on an open source project or projects, but I've got value add, so you're going to license it from me? And in that case, do you evaluate that in terms of, you know, just the same as any other vendor acquired software, or do you look at it as under the open source criteria, or do you have some sort of a hybrid model? And, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing when you hear that?
I mean, like if they base it on a piece of open source that isn't in their OCAD?
Right. So it's a new application, a new tool. Here it is. You know, licenses from us because we've added value to this project. How do you look at that?
A good example might be MyEclipse, which is a vendor-provided piece of code that runs within the Eclipse IDE. It provides great functionality. Now, the truth is many of the pieces of functionality provided by MyEclipse are provided by other open source projects, other add-ins to the Eclipse IDE that you could probably pull in yourself and cobble together. It's added value. As Dan noted earlier in our presentation, cost is an angle, but we're really looking for functionality, support, and long-term value. So if it meets those criteria, we would choose it.
Some of the companies behind some of the open source projects have some particularly interesting business models. One of them was asking us for $50,000 to make an update to the source code. So.
Oh, you want wheels with that car.
Paul Gillen, I'm a consultant. Following up on that, what have you found? Can you contrast the experience of dealing with some of these new open source companies versus the more mature proprietary vendors? What is the experience different?
Very different. You know, you go to the Mozilla Foundation and they've got that big tin can bridge in their offices. I don't know whether you've ever been there. And the next day I was going to Microsoft, and you go out to this palatial entertainment complex for executives. It's a very different experience working with them. I feel personally more closer to the Mozilla model because you're really talking to the people that are engaged with the project, that have an influence over it, the ability to change it, to enhance it for you, and there's a much closer connection to them. with an enterprise of a scale of a Microsoft, it's difficult to influence and suggest updates and changes, the enhancements they could make to the project. So it's a different experience.
So you're this huge company with billions of dollars in assets, okay, and all that under your control.
Trillions
that you control. And you like the warm, fuzzy feeling of the small company as opposed to the comfort of being in the country club with another large company.
It depends. We like.
I mean, it does. I was like, whoa.
We like to be able to influence.
Okay.
We have a job to get done. We have mission-critical businesses that we are in today and that we are looking to move into.
Yeah.
And there's functionality we need. There's turnaround that we need. And different people are allowed to provide that in different ways. Some of Microsoft's products are nimble. Some of them aren't. In general, in the open source community, we found things are very nimble.
Do you put money in to make things be nimble when you want it to be nimble, or do you just depend on the persuasive power? You're a big company, but you don't buy things necessarily from Mozilla or something. So how do you persuade them?
We either help them with resources,
okay,
and in the overall design and enhancement of their product, and not only with open source, but also with small startups too.
Yeah.
You know, there are various companies that we've worked in the past that were not even making a profit, and we worked with them to the point where they become fully independent companies and so on. So we like to be engaged very early on because we can really influence and have competitive advantage that way. You know, even with larger companies, there are some larger companies whose organization is well suited to that process of influence and engagement. TIBCO has been a very good company for us to work with, and we've done some various bells and whistles that have enabled us to do certain market data things that we wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
Okay, so this is this ecosystem that Nick, you were talking about. They're part of it. Do you, Julie, want to say?
Yeah.
Are you learning something, or can you? Are you already doing some of this stuff?
Well, I think going back to looking at some of the things you were talking about with the small development firms and things like that and being able to influence, where we're not really using an open source model for to any great extent. I think what we've done is look at being a local regional company, leveraging our partnerships with the association, our relationship with the other blues across the country, and then some of our partnerships with our vendor partners like in EDS, which is a global organization. I think we get to influence, or we hope to influence an awful lot in the future. So I don't necessarily agree you have to have that sort of intimate sort of background to be able to influence.
Yeah, one of the things I didn't show in slide form, but we think is vital to the overall open ecosystem, is what we call the three aspects of openness. So one of the things we've been focusing on a lot today is the open legal framework, right? All the licenses and so on, they give you the permissions to do what you need to do with the source code. And that's where I think too much time is spent, because we're all amateur attorneys. Right. The second area, which I think we're touching on right now, is what we call the open community. Right, you can have an open source license, you can dump it out there, but there's no real community behind it where your influence or your comments and constructive criticism can really have an impact. So that open community is a lot harder to build and architect, but probably even more important than the open legal framework. And the third one is the open technical architecture. We all know of projects that were once proprietary that just got dumped over. And while, you know, there's supposedly a community there, mostly from the vendor, and there is an open legal framework, the technical characteristics of that source code, you know, are so, you know, poorly designed that you really can't extend and enhance it. So all three of those things have to be there for a successful open source project.
So the fact that it's open source, if it was more, we heard in our last meeting that we had where they were talking, people who had been on the Mono project and stuff like that were talking about it, about how hard it was to turn it into open source, to open sourceify things. But once you've built it, assuming that multiple people are going to modify it, that's now a risk thing you look at, a quality of something that if you built a hairball, that's bad, but if you build something that's modular in the right way for modification.
Yeah. You could call it decentralized innovation. That is, you have to architect the software in sometimes unique ways to allow independent innovation versus it's always the vendor that innovates, and you just make your request into the vendor, and when they get to it, they'll do it. Or you own it, it's custom code, so you do all the innovation. Letting multiple parties innovate independently, but in a unified way, that's hard to architect, technically as well as community-wise.
It's a continued valuable...
It's hugely valuable. It's probably the most valuable aspect of open source is you can innovate at your own rate of change and in directions that you feel are a benefit.
Take something like the .NET framework and all the .NET stuff. The Microsoft, after the time that open source was already popular, they could have architected. Did they, as you see it, have they architected their stuff in this modular way so they can move that stuff or not? Or what about Oracle and some of the other places?
Well, I mean, .NET's kind of interesting because it is actually an open standard, 75%, right? It is an ECMA standard. .NET was put through the standards process, and that's how Mono and so on were able to do what they did. Despite that, I don't want to comment on the modular structure of .NET because I really don't know it all that well, frankly. But when there's an ethos, there's an assumption when there's a small development team that is all self-contained that leads to certain assumptions about how you document the code, how you source code manage it, and so on. They just are missing, frankly, when you're going to do it in a more open, decentralized way. So forget just the architecture of the modules, just the way one sets up source code management and modification rights, that in itself can make things less or more open to decentralized innovation.
So internally, a proprietary company could run their stuff to have some of these benefits, but there's forces for them not to, but they could have. So now they should show people that they have to show that they're equal to the open source stuff.
Absolutely.
From your... And, of course, you guys are going to mark them on that? Or is that not what Gartner
You'll
does?
You'll need a criteria in the magic quadrant. Somewhere.
Other questions? Oh, we got another question over here. That's why I wear my running shoes.
Rich Grady with Applied Geographics in Boston. This may be a question more for the gentleman from Gartner. There seem to be different rates of adoption for open source in different vertical segments. And I'm curious whether or not you agree with that, first of all, and if so, what maybe some of the key reasons are that account for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it tracks pretty much the general IT aggressiveness and strategic use of IT that you find across industries. So certainly financial services, especially capital markets and equities and that kind of stuff, versus like insurance, which is financial services. Those guys are always at the bleeding edge, and always will be, because just so much value you can derive from IT. In other areas, we've seen industries like pharmaceuticals, surprisingly, do a lot of open source. I think that's some of the R&D part of their heritage, where a lot of the scientists and engineers and so on, use open source to do the actual molecular DNA and whatever kind of usage. And then you get the laggards, and I won't name names here, but the ones you think of typically of having a very small percentage of revenue or what have you spent on IT are also typically behind on open source adoption.
Any other burning questions? Yes, because we're running out of time.
This is for Mike. You've mentioned my name is Mark from Opteros. You've mentioned Mozilla favorably on several different occasions. To what extent is this deployed in your organization, and where does it sit? And is there any cost associated with it?
Great questions. Before we formally kicked off our project, we had about 1,000 people that were using Firefox, and most of those had been downloaded by developers who were working on the Fidelity.com side, and they were using it to ensure that the functionality provided by Fidelity.com worked on that browser. It wasn't until that Firefox reached around that 5-6% of market penetration that we started to look at it very seriously as an in-house alternative, and that was really the kickoff of the project. So.
Okay, one last question.
One real easy question for you, which is are you going to participate in the GPL3 process? Are you going to encourage your attorneys to?
No, you don't know.
I don't know.
Okay.
I would say not likely.
I don't know. Do you know, Chuck?
I know that some of our lawyers are very interested. Very interested to see how it goes. Of course, some projects have licensing built in that when there is a new version of GPL, they will automatically take on the characteristics of that new version. Others have chosen specifically to be locked into particular versions of GPL. And so we care. Are we going to actually participate? I don't know the answer.
Let me give you my feeling on that, which is that everybody who has been saying, well, the GPL was good here or we have a problem there, you better participate because that's how it's going to end up being where you want. If you want to make sure that the process doesn't end up where you don't want, or at least it will be discussed how to deal with that by others, I've talked to Eben about this. He said, please, they want people from all sides, even people who completely disagree with Stallman on stuff, to provide their input. They're still going to decide what they decide, but it will make a difference, and it could be the one word that lawyers will tell you is the word that mattered to you for what you want to get done. And also, so please participate, not just your lawyers, but you responding with your lawyers, where the lawyers say, oh, I don't like where this is going. You know, you got to say, well, this is how it'll affect me, so you can put the business reasons back in also, as well as the technologist speaking from the heart about what is helping in terms of, you know, this question of will it actually make more open source software, will it be better for softwaredom, is it better for the world, et cetera, like that. Okay? So thank you very much, everybody.